The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
Today on The Cyber Show, we tear a bite out of SD cards. Kevin goes willy-nilly on warrants. Sean blows through billions. Ira tells us what he knows others don't know. Peter pulls his punches with no memory. Wynn gets into the Highlands with Harold, and Sin starts without Sin. And lots more, all on this week's Cyber Show.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
All.net's February monthly members forum will be on Valentine's Day, Tuesday, the 14th of February. If you love, you gotta come.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news from The Cyber Show. Cybersecurity researchers have demonstrated that conversational AI can write attack programs in only a few hours. Meanwhile, physical security researchers have demonstrated that hammers can be used to kill people. Working together, they have implemented an internet-based hammer defense that prevents hammers from swinging near people.
This is a segment we call Sin in America.
We're talking to Cynthia about her practice, which is focused on internet investigations. She started at the end, so I guess that's where we'll start. So you're sitting in a pastor's office in a church you acquired to run your business. Is that right?
Fred, what I did was in COVID, I had another building. It was a small house that I outfitted out for investigations, just like an attorney or an accountant would do. And being right outside of New York City, houses were selling like hotcakes for real good prices. So I sold the house, and this building is a church. It's an old clapboard Protestant church, right there on the market, a half a mile up from where I was at. And to me, that's 7,000 square feet of space, you know, big open spaces. And we have an expression here: in God we trust, all others we monitor. So
as opposed to paying cash, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we left the cross on a roof, and we just retrofitted the entire inside of the building. The pastor's office, it was like a rock and roll church, you know, one of those old, like, they're more probably about the music than they were about the religion.
I like that, but okay.
Oh, yeah. No, the people here were wonderful. They were, you know, getting old and moving. So when I picked up, there was a lot of leftover material in here. You know, there was a lot of musical
benches.
Oh, yeah.
And they left all the pews. So the pews are great. You know, they're just wonderful seating for all sorts of events, right?
Oh, yeah. I have more chairs than I'll ever sit in my life. But we donated as much as we could. You know, we gave away what we could. It was a good reason. And we reallocated what we could. And the Bibles, because, you know, I'm an old school, you know, Italian Catholic girl, we can't throw Bibles away. So what we did is as we're building out the walls, we put the Bibles in the walls.
There you go. A unique solution. So now, was there a pipe organ?
No, it was
too bad, because that would be really awesome, you know, be able to.
I get it. There was a lighting booth and a sound booth, though. So they had a lot of the original analog equipment.
Yeah. Do you use this for your classes? Do you hold classes in the big room or?
No, I keep the staff in the big room. So this way they're, you know, obligated to do the right thing every day. The basement of the church, we actually hold the classes in. And actually right now it's all retrofitted with like just typical office stuff. But there's a lot of flair, you know. I mean, this is me, and I just can't stop myself. So there's a lot of unique touches. We've got the back of the building is all old school detective agency, and the front of the building is all cyber techno, you know, two sides of our biz.
Yeah. So those physical security folks are in the back room. You don't want them to know, but they're watching you, right?
That's it. That's it. Okay. We're all back here. I had, it's actually been a lot of fun because the carpenters and the construction workers and that I work with, they're all very creative. So I've got the old like Barney Miller, like glass doors coming into.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. With names on them. And yeah.
Yeah, so
That's a great show, by the way. You know, they've been putting it up again, so you can watch all the episodes. So I binge watched the whole thing. You know, put it on the DVR. Absolutely. All right. So now this is probably, we just recorded probably the last episode.
And now a word from our sponsor. Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Our next All.net members forum will be at 11 o'clock that same day. To attend, sign up to our mailing list through thecybershow.co.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. Peter, welcome. How are you doing these days?
I'm hanging in there.
We've been trying to get the history of the cyber world starting, and I know you've been in it for a long time, longer than me, and people say I've been in it for ancient times. So I wanted to just start out with how you got, you know, your first involvement with computers and or anything else cyber.
Well, my first job was 1953, working for the Navy as a student aid trainee, writing a complex matrix inversion program on a card program calculator that had four registers and no memory, punch card reader and a puncher. And it was a deck of about 2 feet long. That was the program. And then you put the data deck at the back and you ran it through and it punched out two cards and you put those at the back and you ran it through again and it got four cards. And you kept going until it stopped and then you multiplied.
So that was the storage at the end of each step that you were adding to the end. That was just part of the extending.
Right. There was no memory. There were four registers and the thing that was programmed.
The partial results are at the end. You know.
It was programmed on a plug board. Essentially a hardware compiler.
But it was digital though, right?
Yeah, it converted the whole thing into a three address instruction set.
Yeah.
A plus B goes into C, and it was murder to program because it didn't have any memory.
So, you know, in that era, there were also analog computers, although, you know, I didn't use analog computers for quite a few years after that.
Yeah.
But you would also plug those parts in, but it would give you the analog solution to, you know, any sort of continuous arithmetic problem.
Yeah. Well, what goes around comes around. I took a course on analog computing in 1954, I think it was. And so I learned about digital differential analyzers that were just coming in at the time. And I learned about the old cylinder wheel kind of analog devices, integrators. And what has come around when you get to the security problem is that there was a paper at the Oakland conference, the IEEE Security and Privacy Symposium, maybe 6 years ago, where they took, this is called the A2 paper. They took a resistor and a capacitor and threw it under the board, and they were able to generate Trojan horses.
Sure. At the hardware level, it's not just that. There's all sorts of timing attacks associated.
This was with analog devices, okay? Not digital.
But that's obviously the case, right? Because any analog device, you know, that's how you do integration, is with a resistor and a capacitor, right?
Yeah, of course.
You know, you want to change the equation, just change the components.
Yeah, so that was the start. Then along came Multics in 1965. I've been at Bell Labs since 1960, working on error correcting codes and error limiting sequential machines and all kinds of things.
Before you rush on to Multics, tell us about the error correcting codes and error limiting sequencing. That's actually quite interesting to me.
Well, that was fascinating stuff. I wrote a paper in 63, and I got a call from David Huffman at MIT. He said, "Hey, Peter, I'm just reviewing this paper you wrote on self-resynchronizing information lossless sequential machines," which is the paper that he had written. And I showed that some of them actually worked forwards and backwards, and they were such that if there was a hardware error, they were self-correcting. And
a single hardware error? You mean a flip?
A single multiple error, doesn't matter. Whatever it was, it would.
No, eventually you get enough errors so it won't run, right?
Yeah, but that's certainly true. But this was a case where the thing was in fact self-correcting, as well as reversible. And so I went up and I met Dave, and we became very wonderful friends over the years. He invited me in 64, he invited me out to Stanford to teach for a quarter. And so that was sort of the beginning. But I, my thesis stuff was on essentially error-limiting Huffman codes. The average Huffman code has a, if you drop a bit or two or three, four.
Oh, yeah, no, it's unbelievable. It's completely, it's because it's minimal, so you just could get anything from there.
Yeah, forward. So some of them are self-correcting, and some of them, there are some, what are called anagrammatic codes. Schützenberger discovered this, that the code is its own reversal backwards. So it turns out this is, any error of a particular type propagates forever. So the code was its own homing sequence, and I developed the whole theory of self-resynchronizing systems as a result. Right.
Okay, Brett, that's an interesting start to a career.
Yes, very interesting.
Yes, writing programs that if you put them in backwards, bit by bit, they still work, right?
Yes.
So this coding theory is something I did early on as well. And of course, I was, you know, my dissertation, besides Len Edelman, who's good on the cryptographic side, we had Irving Reed and Saul Galam, who were both coding guys. So, you know, when I went into their office for the meetings, they would be talking to me about different coding schemes. And of course, I learned about Huffman codes and trying to optimize and efficiencies and so forth. And then what I think Peter's talking about is things like CRC codes, cyclic redundancy codes, that allow you to do correction of errors, but doing it sequentially instead of in parallel. You have any experience in that space? And what do you think of this early description of computing where you run the punch cards through and they punch you another card that you add to the end, and that's the memory?
I just remember from my days of programming on an IBM 360 using punch cards, we had something called the rubber band bandito. And what that was is a user of the system would make the mistake of not removing the rubber band around their card deck.
Oh, no.
Because you had, like, Peter described there, you had a large number of individual cards that you would punch. And when you fed those into the card reader to read them into the computing system, that rubber band would snap and get caught in the machinery. And that was a self-denial of service, but it was also a denial of service for everybody that wanted to use that mainframe. Because we'd have to call a technician would have to come in to untangle the card reader mechanism. So, yeah.
But you needed the rubber band, because without the rubber band beforehand, the cards would slip around and fall out of order. And if they went out of order, of course, that's like reordering the instructions in your program.
Right. And the other thing that brought back to mind was programming on a mainframe like that with the card decks. That was where I learned my first computer attack technique, which was to, what I didn't actually do it, but I learned about it, was to cause the heads on the storage device, devices used by the mainframe, to read at the very, at sector one and then, or sector zero at the beginning, and then go all the way, and then actually mechanically move the heads all the way to the end and cause thrashing, meaning moving from beginning to the end, to the beginning to the end, and it caused a mechanical failure. So it was early cybersecurity risk, even though you had a perimeter.
But you know that still works, right?
Yeah.
You can still go and bang controls on disk drives and wipe them out. And then they're still using it for things like dissemination of information, right? You push things back and forth to the mechanical or electrical end, and you use that to generate signals, right? So there's a lot of covert channels associated with it. And there's, it's also slows down the processing. Even if you don't break it, it slows things. So you can reallocate locations of storage and of cache storage and so forth to cause the machine to thrash and create paging behavior. Yeah, so there's all sorts of this stuff. But how about now? Remember, these are 80 column cards, and the last eight columns are for the Hollerith code. So right. You could put card numbers on them so that if the deck fell over, you can put it into a sorter and resort it by the last eight columns, eight sorts. You start with to resort your deck so you could get it back sorted and then put it back in. But you're talking about mainframes that had memory.
Yes.
So this is the same thing, but instead of memory, the punch card, the reader also has a puncher. So you read in so you would end up punching cards as well as reading the cards, and those punch cards that come out at the end of the deck, that's what he's adding onto the deck and then putting it back into another cycle. So this was right. even more painful.
Yes, and it goes beyond a generation before me. My father worked at NASA, and even before that, he worked at Sperry and Burroughs on the early computers. He used the patch cords that Peter described. Basically, you set up the computation for one instruction, then save state, and then you had to reprogram by reattaching your patch cords for the next operation that you wanted the computer to perform.
Yeah, now there was another thing that happened, and I don't know if you ever did this, but it got to the point where I knew how to use a hole punch and change the punch cards, because rather than going, because, you know, there weren't that many editing stations available. So if you had a minor edit, you could just take a hole punch and punch a card or put a piece of tape over a card and fill in a hole to change the program. So did you ever end up doing that, or you never got to that extreme?
I never got to that extreme. So,
all right. So you're a newbie.
Yes, I do remember, though, that only certain people were allowed to use the CRTs, cathode ray tube terminals, when they first came out, where you had a keyboard and you could actually, just like in a modern computer, see what you're typing on a terminal. But yes, I experienced the pain in the early days and finally got to use a keyboard and a terminal.
But it's also a different world in the way everything functions, because writing a program at that time was mostly in your mind and on paper and thinking and analyzing and getting it right. Because unlike today, where you make a typo and you push the button and it says, oh, you made a typo, and you go fix it. You know, a typo in those days would cost you a half hour and get back in line.
Yes. Yes. And we actually did. It actually forced discipline in the design of software. Thought about the problem. You came up with your requirements. Then you actually drew out a flow chart with the logic, and the computing resource time was quite expensive at the time. So you wanted to try to get your program to run correctly in the first or maybe second or third try. So you did a lot of work on it with paper and pencil to plan out your program, then put it
I noticed you said pencil and not pen. Because not you needed an eraser.
Yes, you did.
Yes, you did. Whereas once you punch the card, unless you have a piece of tape and a used, you know, a hole from previously, you can't go edit the card. You got to go punch another.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story.
So here with Kevin, sort of the original Cyber Cop. And I know one of the things that, you know, you taught me that I learned about, you know, minimization in the search and seizure process is very important. People have this concept that somehow I get a computer and I search it, you know, like a phantom, a mad person. I find whatever's there and then I go out and use it. And that's just not how this stuff works, right? You know, just talk us through what the real requirements are for searching a computer once you have a warrant.
Well, and it's true in the physical world as well as the cyber world. I mean, if you have a warrant to search premises, building, an office, whatever, you need to make some statement as to what evidence of what crime or crimes you believe you may find at that location. Now, it's easier to minimize when it comes to certain kinds of physical evidence. For instance, you may go in on a search warrant for a fraud case, and while you're there in open, you know, right on a desk is an open document that has to do with tax fraud. So the agents didn't have to ignore something that was considered to be in so-called plain sight. Now, the plain sight doctrine in the computers is a little different animal, because when you go into a computer, you can limit the kinds of file or file types or files that you're looking for. But with steganography and some of the other ways of hiding some of these files, you may have to dig deeper than you would ordinarily have to dig to find files that in fact do have evidentiary value.
So when you get that warrant, do you have to say there's the potential for steganography, so we're going to be looking here? You need some basis to claim to the judge that you know that you believe on a reasonable basis with evidence that something is there and you're looking for that thing in that place, right?
Yeah, and also this idea of how you explain that as far as minimizing your search, you can do a lot of looking around without conducting a search or a seizure necessarily, because a lot of these things are either open in open locations, or they may be a group of people who are engaging in some of these things undercover. or not undercover, but doing it in the deep web, whatever you want to call it these days. But law enforcement or cyber cops do have an opportunity to go in and misrepresent themselves and get into some of these chat rooms and whatnot.
That's an intelligence process, right?
Well, that's my point, Fred. The intelligence process is where you gather information that may allow you to go in and say you're going to be looking at certain files because you believe they're encrypted or they're steganography. They've been stegoed, basically.
Yeah, but you can't just go through these operations willy-nilly either, right? You need the proper authority by a judge to go and do that, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so undercover operations require authorization as well, and they're also limited, right?
Yes, and there are standards that have been set by various entities, state, local, federal system, of course, but they do have some standards that they have to follow when it comes to engaged in undercover operations on the internet.
Yeah, and these work in the cyber arena just as they work in the physical arena. They have the same legal requirements and so forth, right?
Similar. I don't know if I can say they're identical, but they are similar, yes.
Right. So again, no willy-nilly searches, none of this kind of stuff.
You can lie about your identity, but not always about your purpose. If your purpose is to get confidential information, you may be able to identify yourself as someone who you really are not. But once you've lied about your identity, then you may be limited as to what you can actually gather, whatever, in terms of what you're after.
Right. Well, the concept is you're allowed to find crimes, but you're not allowed to induce them, right?
That's another issue. Absolutely right. Yeah, that's one that is widely misunderstood, because this concept for entrapment that's another concept I taught for many years. If somebody is predisposed to commit a crime, you're more than welcome to go in and take advantage of their predisposition. That's one of the things. That's one of the parts of entrapment that when the defense raises it, we go and say, look, your guy was more than ready to get involved in further criminal activity. So he was not entrapped.
But on the other hand, that's completely different than when you go in and, say, offer some child pornography to somebody who's a suspect.
Well, if you offer, the other thing is there are some severe limitations on offering any real child pornography, let's put it that way, from part of law enforcement. The other thing is people don't realize is anybody who has possession of that is potentially a criminal. And so you have to be very careful about under what circumstances anybody, even in law enforcement, can possess these images. And that's another reason why I think they went into the hashing.
Yeah, well, I was only allowed to do it under a court order in a controlled way and in a controlled system. But it's not just things like child pornography. There's all sorts of other things that you can do. In some ways, it's really no different than if I have, illegal drugs, right? I can't offer to sell somebody illegal drugs if I'm a policeman unless I have some prior basis to say that they're in possession or... If I come up to somebody on the street and say, hey, man, you want to buy a joint, which is what they used to do, in Berkeley in the 1960s, to everybody, not the police, the dealers there. But if I say, hey, you want to buy a joint, and they say yes, probably entrapment, right? Unless there's some prior reason to believe that they were buying joints, right?
Well, to be able to show that it wasn't entrapment, the prosecution would have to show that there was some predisposition for that person to engage in an illegal act. If you approach a perfectly innocent civilian and you offer him drugs, that's a good case for entrapment.
Well, it's a good case for drug dealing, too. So the officer who's making the sale is presumably doing something illegal as well. So police can't do things that are illegal either, right?
No, I mean, correct.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But what constitutes illegal is different in some circumstances because they get permission from the court or authorization from some authorized mechanism to do that act that would otherwise be illegal, right?
Yeah, that was one of the issues that came up while the standards, or I think they were called guidelines, that Department of Justice ended up developing for online investigations. That was one of the issues that came up and had a fair amount of very animated discussions. Yep.
Yeah. In fact, I remember the law changed after 9/11 about what you could and could not do in terms of interstate, because it used to be a horrible problem that all the telecommunications over the internet were going interstate. They might go anywhere along the way. So you couldn't pursue legal recourse across state lines for a state agency because of jurisdictional limitations. And then the federal government couldn't take over all of those investigations. I mean, they weren't even necessarily federal crimes in many cases. So all that changed after 9/11 with that change in the law, right?
Well, what happened was, like you mentioned, with the state local jurisdictions, they were not able to reach jurisdictionally their boundaries or jurisdictions. But what ended up happening was the Bureau ended up going, working together with state and local law enforcement. And that's one of the things that the New York Sex Crime Crimes Task Force is very successful at, is bringing in people from state, local, even tribal governments to share information. And also,
when you say the Bureau, you mean the FBI, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah, because there's also the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and similar thing for every state, right?
Yes.
So as I've said before, legal issues to me look like software, look like code, if this, then that, and so forth, and all the same issues apply. And as you see, with friends of yours and mine, like Kevin, like Charles, a lot of people in law enforcement get into computers, particularly in the early days, and they're not really getting, they don't think they're getting into computers. You know, I'm not really programming a computer. I'm just creating this spreadsheet, this data set, this database. And, you know, as a well-known Pollyanna, I think this actually does apply. I think we have good things in the future that we can see coming out of cybersecurity. In the same way as we talk about with so many different topics and guests, if you can express relationships in code, in legal contracts, and we have to, you know, for supply chain security, as an example, then we should be able to apply these same sort of processes, not just technology, but process. How do we break things down? Because everybody I know in law enforcement, you know, is trying to do the job. And everybody I know in legislation, you know, trying to write laws and build laws, you know, local level and the federal, they're trying to find ways to put work together that allow these things to be done. And there's unpleasant topics to get in that conversation. But, you know, we all agree, look, you know, I'm an American. I've belonged to every bloody political party. I want to be Davy Crockett, libertarian, but some social cohesiveness and some order. And I want the law enforcement to take care of necessary ways that are transparent and support the liberties of citizens and individuals, which at the end of the day is a lot to me, like all the stuff we work on in cybersecurity.
So to me, when I listen to these descriptions, I see people who just don't get it as the majority of the population. And the reason people are deceived about a lot of these things, I think one of the reasons we get a lot of influence operations that are aggressive is because people don't understand the reality of what the legal system is. These constraints, these are real. You get the CSI effect where you see these TV shows and somebody grabs the computer, looks at everything on it and says, well, I didn't find this, but I did find that. And, you know, they rush off and go do things. And all of that things happening in a very short time frame and we can find anything. And all this is just baloney. You know, you have to constrain yourself when you do the searches. You need warrants. They need to say what you're looking for, where you're looking. If you're going to try and claim that there's steganography or encryption on it, you need a basis. You can't just go off and do it. If you're going to even search for what the software is on the computer to see if there's software that does steganography, you need permission to do that and a basis for that, or else you're subject to illegal search and seizure. So I just think it's sort of fundamental that people, there's a big difference between people's understanding of law enforcement and how it works and the reality of law enforcement. And in the cyber arena in particular, the expectation of the evidence you're going to get is so much higher than the reality of the evidence you sometimes can get.
In the cyberspace, you take two things people generally don't know a lot about, right? You know, as you're saying, all about law in the first place, how it actually works, and then computers. Can't you just look at the computer? No, right? And you combine those two practices. And I think what you find is again, where we are at the maturity of developing this entire global communications, you know, in many of my shows, I, you know, reach back to the French Revolution and earlier to try to think through. We're all trying to figure out how we can all talk to each other, not just electronically, but, you know, in a civil way, in an open way, with you know, reasonable rules that we are on average enforced fairly. So again, I think the cyber, you know, even the problems we're having in the cyberspace of law enforcement kind of help, because it helps us define and understand the information space that we're working in and what we can do with it.
You know, we're starting to get the evidence from the January 6th committee, and it is voluminous, right? And they have all these records of, you know, the text messaging and everything else, and yet there's still lots of stuff missing, right, that they couldn't get for one reason or another. And it's sort of fabulous in the public exposure of the limitations of what can be done and how much time and effort it takes to get what sort of information, what you seem to never be able to get, and the mix of testimony and expert witnesses and digital evidence and, you know, the tracking the money, right? All these different things come together and fuse together in order to really understand what's going on and actually convince somebody in a legal way that something's going on. And the bar is so much higher for that than the sort of political discourse that we have and the normal day-to-day discourse we have between people. It's in some sense wonderful to see the extent to which you have to drill down and get a lot of information in order to actually go anywhere in the legal world.
We try to put this in some sort of context. I think about legal things like the liability of a manufacturer when a camera over a highway falls and hits a car and kills somebody. How does that even work out? And we know that works out today. You know, somebody shows up, you know, on the scene, you know, a highway worker or whatnot, and it starts there. And it goes for a year or two or three through the courts with boxes of files and records and all sorts of various things. And I know how, from a technical standpoint, we can resolve that really, really quickly, or at least take huge chunks of it out, where the person shows up on the scene, they look at the broken thing, they can tell what software was running on the smart machine that made that bracket, for example. You know, and which contract goes with that? So what rules were in place? And, you know, just limit the field.
Yeah, you're talking about SBOM and DBOM and these other inventory and traceability and interrelationship software components that are just starting to come online. I mean, we're a long way from the instantaneous execution of that, but we're on the road down there. And boy, is that going to make a difference.
Right. And so, you know, that is coming from, you know, a large part of this is legal. You know, how do I, you know, limit my legal cost, my legal risk? How do I demonstrate that I am doing what I said I did? You know, how do I find out what, you know, in a supply chain case like that, did people upstream live up to the agreements and the laws and so forth?
And attributions of actions to actors. Who did what when, right? That's right. Something, you know, historically we haven't been able to do. And people claim in computers that you can get away with things because nobody can figure out who did it. That's what a lot of this cryptocurrency illegal transactions are all about. But what we find out, of course, is you can figure it out. It just takes a while. But it's getting better and faster to the point where it's not going to take a while. And hopefully we'll be able to catch criminals doing things quickly and efficiently instead of taking forever and not being able to catch most of them because we don't have the resources behind it.
Well, you know, and again, as I said, we're trying to work out, you know, how we have this ideally free, individually free, you know, global community and, you know, all live together at the same time. And I think, you know, there's a lot of cynicism in the world these days. And I think that has to do with a lot with opaqueness. You know, even if people believe they live in a, you know, free place and the authorities and so forth, they're generally, you know, you can't really tell. It is too much effort and takes too much time to see.
Transparency is fundamental and something that cybersecurity missed for a long time. We'll be telling more stories from CyberCops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. and on the web at thecybershow.co.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E.co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Here's another example of the too good to be true. This is the micro SD card with 2 terabytes, blah, 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 for $1.94, which is like
2023 new micro SD card, 2 terabytes, high speed micro SD for phone, computer, camera.
Okay, so legitimately, the 2 terabyte SD flash drive costs, you know, well over $100.
Free shipping, US$1.94.
So it's just baloney. So when you look down the page, it says the actual usable capacity of storage products is about 90% of the label. But when you go to play that back, here's what you actually hear.
The actual percent, 20 usable percent.
And then it helps to clarify why this is.
This is because the capacity algorithms of computers and storage products are different.
Well, no, that's not even close to why. The why is that the device that they send out claims when you plug it into computers to have that capacity, 2 terabytes or what have you. But when you actually go to store things on it, it allows you to put as much information in as you want, but it only remembers the first very small amount of it. Maybe, you know, a megabyte or 10 megabytes or something like that. It allows you to keep writing. It keeps telling you the writing worked and such, and it keeps telling you it stored it, and it may even reflect, you know, some enormous amount of storage stored on it. But when you go to retrieve the data, it only retrieves the first so much of it because it's not actually a real device storing that content. It's just a fake device that makes it look like it has that much content, but it doesn't. So having looked this up, I went out and bought one for $1.98 or whatever it cost at the time. I think it was through Walmart because I wanted to see what the mechanisms did and how they worked and test them and so forth. Well, when I did that, what I found out was just what I told you, it doesn't work. So then I complained to Walmart about it. And you know what Walmart said? Walmart said, oh, well, we'll just cancel the payment. You can keep the device. But they didn't remove it from being able to be sold over their web interface. And as far as I know, they're still selling it today. So lots of people, even though they know, supposedly legitimate vendors, even though they know it's a fraud, they've been told it's a fraud, they've given back the money on the fraud, it doesn't matter, they're still going to sell it because it's a way for them to keep making money. So another classic example of it's too good to be true, a fraud continuing to be perpetrated even by large corporations. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET and you press on books.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by Light, shining the way.
Now, on to our next service provider. Wynn, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Well, thank you for having me, Fred. Doing the usual and trying to get a lot of work done while watching soccer.
Well, there you go. So, you know, we've known each other for, my goodness, must be 30, 40, I hate to say 50 years. Is that about right?
Oh, boy. My first memory of really interacting with you, I think, was 88. If we had done stuff before then, I just don't remember it. But maybe we did.
The fact that you can say a year puts you way better in memory than I am. So.
Oh, okay. Now, I remember there was an event where it was early virus days. And whether that was Michelangelo or whatever, and Dr. Harold Hyland was in the middle of it.
I've been trying to remember his name for a while. Harold was wonderful.
He was a great person to talk to. He taught me a great deal. And that was when all of this, I don't know, there were a bunch of viruses starting to get around a little bit, such as they were, wormish things. And I remember the FBI coming by my house and asking if I was involved in the distribution of them because I had an antivirus product at the time.
Well, so you know that some of the antivirus product folks distributed, you know, simple versions of viruses to boost their sales, right?
I don't know a lot of what everybody else did in those days. It was just noise. You know, we were all trying to do something. And there were a lot of accusations being thrown around back then. And to say I know all of the truth other than what I did, that'd be a lie. I don't know. I know what we did.
Fair enough. So, and I wasn't going to press you on what you did because I want to start earlier than that.
Uh-oh.
So before you were anywhere near what we'll now call cybersecurity, you were a radio guy, right?
Not specifically. I did some radio work, but I was a recording engineer and producer. My father produced and worked with Dylan, Peter, Paul, and Mary. Louis Armstrong gave me my first trumpet lesson. I grew up in that environment. My mother
It was the music industry, not the radio industry.
Well, the radio was a distribution. We would do work that would go out on radio, quite obviously. I did 100 live radio shows, live albums from a country rock and roll place in New York in, 78, 79. And then did a bunch of TV shows, Liza with a Z, Applause, Sweet the Pops. So the radio and TV was the output of, you know, what the broadcast was. But the majority of the work that we did was either live concerts, live TV shows, or in the studio. So it was a combination of all of those things. Whatever was needed, we'd figure out a way to do.
So are you going to go back into the production business and come work for me building out my radio stations?
The best I would have to offer today would be voice. That's it. I'm not digging down in that again. During COVID, it was fun. A buddy of mine said, hey, I got a attic full of old audio equipment. You want it? So I bought it all from him and then spent part of COVID, I guess 4 months, rebuilding it all just for memory's sake and to see if I could still do it.
Do you have a radio voice you can share here?
I don't try to ever put on a voice. I mean, hi, this is how you can do all that kind of crazy, but I never did that. I just, here's my voice. That's it. Let's move on. I'm just not comfortable doing that. I had to once in a while back in the day, one of the voice talents might not show up to do a commercial or a jingle and they'd recruit me to do it. And, they give me $20 instead of, the $100 I was supposed to get. But that was fine. You know, it was just all part of learning the business way back when.
I love Wynn so much, right? Wynn was the one who coined the term digital Pearl Harbor. Was that right?
I'm not sure who came up with that phrase first, nor is that important because Wynn's contribution has been vast in a lot of different areas. Right. I think it's just so cool that he starts out in radio and in recording and ends up doing the sort of everything that you do, working in his dad's shop in radio.
Well, we've talked about this a lot, right? And there's this characteristic of this generation of cybersecurity folks, that there was no linear path. You couldn't take a class, couldn't go to school. You literally had to, you just came from wherever. And now, 30, 40 years later, each of us, all these folks, we talk to on shows like this, it's two things. One, it's just a fascinating, a great story, right? Full of stories. Oh my God, what a community. And the other one is, it's an opportunity, right? What is it about us, given that we all came from all these different backgrounds? However, a lot of similarities. What were they? I think you find a lot of it in music and entertainment, creativity. It's a bloody fascinating group of folks.
It's part that, but it's also, I think there's some mix between panache and technology, right?
Right.
You see a lot of people in technology are sort of, I'll call it introverts. It's, I'm not a psychologist, but they don't really like to communicate with other people. And then there are a lot of people who are very communicative who are very often in sales.
Right.
And it's fascinating to see the people who are tech savvy, who like doing that stuff, who like doing the math and such, but who are also into the communication part of it.
Right. It's a multiple filter thing, right? We each of us get here through some rough filter that we all fit through the holes, right? That aggregate composite of all of us, all of technology people, in the world. Lots of different types of folks.
Maybe that's right. Maybe it's that's the only keyhole that works at the beginning of a field. And because it was so immature, now, you can be anything you want and there's plenty of work to do in cybersecurity or in cyber everything, right? Forget about security as part of cyber. Just talking about building networks, right? So there's plenty of this stuff to do no matter what your ilk is. You can be a psychologist, you can be into communication, anything. And you can find a huge spot in cyber because cyber has just infused into everything. It's everywhere.
Well, there's no good or bad about this, right? It's easy to say, things aren't like they used to be, and they aren't, and they never were, or are in any case. Quite often they never even were, but,
yeah, they never were is probably right.
Well, what is true is there are frontier days, right? There's sometime, new things happen all the bloody time, and sometimes they're exactly right, but they're the wrong time or whatnot. But sometimes the ground is just fertile. Right. And change starts and people start saying, I want to do this crazy thing. And at first there's a few and then it grows and then it becomes endemic. Right. And now it's better for cybersecurity as a whole. It's better if you want a job for cybersecurity today because you can figure out what it is. You can take a class, you can get a certificate, you can do it. But it's not the same thing. It's nothing is right. That first group that gets into something. Has a bunch of people like Wynn and you and arguably me, a bunch of crazy people who just have the right set of talents. And each time you look at this one, again, you break it down, it gets fascinating. Technology, security, communications, what is it about that group? And what can we extract from the lesson that this demographic gathered around this topic in this frontier day?
All right, but there's one other thing to note, and that is with a voice like Wynn's, with that deep voice.
He doesn't need a radio voice. He is a radio voice.
I know. It's unbelievable. Right. When he stands up and speaks, people listen.
When I met him, he was giving a great talk, and there was a get-together, a bunch of us got together at a restaurant somewhere, and I rode in on my 5-foot-long, tropical hardwood sailboat, a duckbill a skateboard. And we didn't necessarily bat an eye. That's the thing about this group of maniacs, right? You know, it's just not surprising at all to find out that, you know, yeah, that you know, Wind has spent, you know, the last 2 years restoring a bunch of old audio gear as well.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Our next Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting will be February 14th, Valentine's Day, at 9 a.m. Pacific. Our next All.net members forum will be at 11 o'clock that same day. To attend, sign up to our mailing list through thecybershow.co.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
Well, now, on to our next company. Sean from PowerGrow, welcome back. Okay, so let's talk about money. Everything you've told us about PowerGrow is better, faster, less expensive, more efficient, better for the world in every way. And you've told us that you're going to get up into the third of a billion dollar range of production within the next 2 years in terms of the amount of vegetables you're going to produce and just growing from there based on what? Is it a financing issue? What does it take for you to expand this thing?
Yeah, and that's really a core part of what PowerGrow does. So the reason you don't see more farmers developing high-tech glass greenhouses is they're fairly capital intensive. So our first five-acre facility in Texas, including 50,000 square feet of processing space, is north of $40 million. But we've developed partnerships with some really innovative land lease companies and banks. So our job is to provide both the debt and equity stack for the grower. And what's unique is we treat it as a single-tenant triple net lease to the grower, so they're not putting up a lot of capital up front. They're conserving their capital for operations. In Q1, we plan to go out for a $300 million green bond issuance that will allow us to build Birmingham, the Beltway, and the Chicagoland greenhouses all in parallel. And when you think about a green bond, they're typically structured for projects that may not get home financially or don't have good returns, but are good for the world. In our case, we're incredibly good for the world, but we have an incredible return for the bondholders. And
so when you talk about a bond, you're talking about like municipal bonds?
Well, it's not a municipal bond because we're not a municipal entity. So they end up, but it's a green bond effectively.
So explain how this works. Because look, $40 million times 10 of them is $400 million, and you're going to be producing $300-400 million worth of net output every year. So The payback is probably, well, you don't get 100% of that, of course. You only get a small percentage of that to pay back the land, right?
Well, so we'll end up owning the greenhouses either directly or in partnership with the grower. The grow operation pays the lease on the facilities and the power purchase agreement. You know, they pay for the kilowatt hours we generate with the solar and the fuel cells. So our goal as a company is to basically be an asset management company where we own greenhouses and power generation systems all around the country and ultimately around the world and manage those assets effectively to help a grower scale.
All right, but let's talk about investors, right? So if I'm a farmer, if I'm a grower and I want to do this, you know, how much money do I put in and how long does it take me to get that money back and how does that work?
Yeah, so our current grower for the Texas project, of the $44.5 million for the project, they're putting in $3.5 million. That's being viewed as equity in the project. So they actually have an equity stake in the greenhouses themselves. That capital is set aside for operating capital.
How do you get the other 90% of the money?
Well, we've got a really innovative debt structure with some of the largest farm lenders in the country, as well as a company that's got a really innovative ground lease product that dramatically reduces the capital required, the equity required for projects. But ultimately, long term, we'll continue partnering with the banks and the land lease company. But ultimately, that's why we want to launch the green bond issuance so that we can deploy that capital and then service the debt on the bonds.
So the rate of growth of this is really determined by financing. So we're talking about if you're going to really expand this thing enormously, there's an enormous amount of financing. How does the investor get their money back?
Well, the investors are investing in basically in the assets we're deploying. And so, you know, the grower's paying the rent and the lease on the facilities, and that capital is returned to the investors over the course of time, depending on whether they're equity investors in the project or if it's the bond issue or the bond investors.
So it's really a real estate play in the sense from the investor's perspective, it's more like real estate than investing in a company.
Yeah, and it's a really attractive. So for this first project, the investors are getting a 10 times cash on cash return from a real estate standpoint, which is a pretty attractive return with a very low risk model. We've got a grower that's got a big balance sheet, has been really successful, and they're the tenant in the facility and they're signing a 25 year lease and then a 25 year power purchase agreement for the facilities.
So 10 times cash on cash over what period of time?
It depends whether they want to stay as equity investors in the assets long term, which they have the right to do, or we can flip them out sometime between years 3 and year 7. Our land lease partner, they actually provide about half the debt capital, but they want to get flipped out of the transaction sometime between years 4 and 7. So they give us a buyout schedule. So the intent is we go through a refi after year 3, flip out the land lease investors and or the equity investors. So the equity investors can own those assets in perpetuity with us, or we can flip them out sometime after year 3.
Interesting. All right. So we have your information on GWiz. So look up PowerGrow on the cybershow.co to get more information and to get in touch with Sean.
People are confused and they think farming is about growing food. You know, this guy definitely grew up on a farm. You know, it's about the financial, you know, orchestration of the whole bloody thing, and food plays a part of it, right? So, as we said, yeah, this guy gives me a good comfort level. Like, you know, he seems to have thought this out. He can answer the question on his feet. He understands the complexities and the systemic nature of all this stuff. I don't know. I mean, in your conversations, your interview with him, you've covered most of the areas of concern that I would have.
Well, so, okay. So, you know, Angel to Exit has this structure that we use for dealing with, you know, understanding and doing diligence on companies. So it goes governance and management, marketing and sales, execution and fulfillment, intellectual property and special sauce, financial situation and path, and legal situation. And whatever you ask him about in any of these areas, he's just got it down. You know, right. I mean, he knows what his company is. And listen to that return. You know, if his numbers are 10 times return in 4 years, 3 to 4 years for the investors, right? As a real estate investor, right? So this is back, and he has the people that start the grow operations have 25-year leases, not just for the facility, but also for the power consumption. So they're making money every month on the lease. So there's good cash flow, right? And the investor who puts in this money can take their money out. Oh, in 3 or 4 years, you can get it all. You know, everything you put in can come out, or you can stay and continue to get the rent for the next 20 plus years, right?
Well, let's remember this is the cyber show, right? You know, so this gives me a lot of hope that I get to see a lot of the things that I really want to geek out in my lifetime, right? And in those same sort of time frames, because you look out over the next three to seven years, not that long, right? In investment terms and everything else, or an infrastructure, and you start to see systems like this deployed. And if you want to look at the data, the situational awareness, you want, you know, to understand, you know, in a previous clip with of your interview, he's talking about the automation and the growth cycle and so forth. Have that in place for 10 years. Have AI staring at every single sprout as it breaks the soil. You know, crunch that data. You know, how do you want to get better efficiencies, better food, faster growth, you know, less energy consumption? The emergent properties of the data collect of the cyber side of this are phenomenal.
Cool. We didn't get a chance to ask him about that during this conversation, but I've talked to Sean for quite a while. So that's, of course.
Yeah, but again, it's emergent because from an investment perspective and everything else, that's lovely. Right now it works. You know, again, save money, lower my cost, be more competitive, be more profitable. Wonderful. But with that in place, all the rest is going to happen anyways, because the same forces will drive the development of that tech.
Yeah. So let me just give you a sense of some of the other things going on in this space, because this is, you know, the ag tech space, like I say, you know, I deal with the folks in Salinas and the ag tech accelerator. And I've been in that field. And you know, I lived on my uncle's farm for a while when I was younger. And we grew mostly cows, but also the things that cows eat. The thing that's going on in this space, there are already the use of cameras to look at plants as they grow. So the agronomists are using different frequencies of light and different sorts of sensors to detect the conditions so they can find disease before it spreads throughout a crop. So in these facilities, you know, sort of hypothetically, theoretically, you shouldn't have any disease. But when you have disease, if you can detect it before it spreads beyond, you know, the first 5 or 10 or 20 plants, bingo, you know, so you've now saved that entire crop and maybe the facility has to get sterilized if you're not careful. But then again, if you have to sterilize the facility, it's not that hard. You just take everything out that's alive, you sterilize the inside with steam or whatever, and you start again. So just this whole issue of crop disease, and then there are other issues associated with the genetics of what we grow, right? So there are risk issues associated with intentionally induced diseases that can destroy crops. There are other, you know, crop-related conditions that tend to destroy crops, all of which get under the control. So it's, you know, temperature and humidity And not just that, the sequence of temperature and humidity and light and other things that you're feeding these plants allows you to optimize that growth cycle and then have it repeated as frequently as you can. So as you start to tune that out, and this is all based on that information you're getting back, it's not just efficiency, it's flavor, it's health of the plants, it's generation after generation, the ability to create more varieties, and everything else.
You know, you watch this arc over time. Right about 10 years ago, I was in Sana'a, Yemen, and at David and April Alley's house. You know, one evening, they brought over two friends, British humanitarian workers. And one was just finished, you know, just going home with like 20 years in the field, and the other one was just coming out. We talked for hours and hours and hours. And the older guy was very cynical, but I left him with some hope. And he shared with me an MIT project, basically four bicycle wheels, a little tray, runs along the rows, you know, looking at individual plants and applying water and nutrients.
Yeah.
You know, and you can do that sort of thing even in Yemen, and the efficiencies gained. It's 10 years later, but these things take a long time. You know, look at John Deere and companies like this. You know, the big ag, you know, machinery going out there is getting more individual. You put in a closed space like this, as I say, you know, it's another forcing function allowing us to not just, again, Paul Ehrlich and the population bomb was a load of phooey, right? You know, there is not a carrying capacity to our ability to create food. I mean, I guess, you know, theoretically there is, but we are vastly nowhere near it.
No, the density of human population can't fill the oceans. Ultimately, we could grow it in and under the oceans if we had to. So I don't think we're going to run out of it because of the inability to create it.
But
it is
making so much more of it better, more available, with less energy, cheaper. You know,
live longer, healthier, happier lives, right? Yeah, diet, exercise, and sleep are the three things that lead to a long, healthy, happy life, according to many studies that have been done, right? So we don't have sleep solved yet, but we'll probably talk to one of those firms soon. In the meanwhile.
Now, onto our next service provider.
We're discussing red teaming with Ira. And let's continue the discussion. We had all sorts of stuff happens, and that's the fun part of it, of course, right?
Yeah.
You don't know what's going to happen, but you have to have a certain perspective and attitude and approach that says, you know, it's all right. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. Tell him whatever you tell him. What's he going to do? At the end of the day, if you're properly authorized and you're doing it legitimately. The other thing is we have these rules. You're not allowed to lie. Certainly can't do anything violent. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, you know, just take it easy. Be nice. Be friendly. Don't worry about it. It's okay.
And I mean, too many. Well, here's the problem, though. You know, you could go ahead and say, we're not going to lie, we're not going to do whatever, but you need to also, there's a difference between getting regularly lucky and being skilled at it. Because the problem is, for example, when I got caught, I've been trained to know what to do when you get in the situation, because anybody could theoretically lie. Anybody could theoretically walk into a building. The problem is that a lot of people who are doing this work, you know, there's like the people who don't know what they don't know, the people who know what they don't know, and then there's the people who know what the other people don't know. Now, the problem is that you have a lot of people doing social engineering who don't know what they don't know, and they could get away with a lot because security is actually really poor. And they think they're genius.
It's because people are who they are, right? That is, there are psychological properties of people, and you're taking advantage of those things. My point of not lying was you never have to. It was just never a problem. Now, in intelligence situations, you know, where you're overseas, that might become more of a problem. So you do have to be prepared for it. But even in those situations, I never encountered a situation where I had to lie. There's always truths you can tell. And in fact, one of the interesting things about it's true. One of the interesting things about police are they are trained to listen to what you say and recognize that you were not answering the question they asked and redirect the question. But one of the best techniques is always just to answer another question that seems similar and people forget what they were thinking or asking or why. Mm-hmm. It sounds interesting. Oh, keep going, move along. They don't have enough time. They don't have enough attention. But police are trained to do that. So with trained intelligence operatives, it's a different world. But in the corporate world, you rarely encounter a trained intelligence operative. You're mostly encountering people who are afraid of their boss. They're afraid of the corporate structure. So the characteristics are such that you can usually defeat it just by telling the truth. When it does, we have also obviously run deception operations, but that's a different sort of game.
So there you have it, right? You know, so, you know, I like your comments there, you know, about truth. You can always find a truth to say, right? And, That plays in exactly what we're talking about last with the last of Iris segments, right? you know, the trust and honesty is a functional part of your security apparatus.
Right. The other thing is, especially for people that aren't skilled and trained at that lying thing, as long as they have a truth to tell, they can tell the truth and not be nervous about it. Some people have difficulty saying things that are not true, even in a situation where they're play acting. So they will not be able to do it if they have to lie. The other thing is lies, you know, they get inconsistent very quickly.
Right.
It's hard to remember the lie. Whereas the truth, well, you know, you remember it because it's real. It's the truth. So you inherently remember the truth, and it's harder to remember things that are lies.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Sin goes electric in bad company. Peter goes into reproduction in cyberspace. Kevin logos into the BBC via the internet. Jose sends a fake PayPal invoice. Wynn tries not to get a job. Ira points companies at puzzle pieces, and lots more. All on next week's Cyber Show. See you there.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.